All right, so tonight we're going to combine two things, accomplish two goals at the same time. Tonight, as the sun sets momentarily here in New York, it will begin Yom Yerushalayim. Yom Yerushalayim is the day, the Hebrew day, the 28th day of Iyar, but 50 years ago, June the 7th, 1967, as we'll soon see on the video, the Israeli army in the third day of the Six-Day War began their ascent to Jerusalem and captured Jerusalem by day 4 or 5, fully. And that's the celebration tonight, and we'll have some celebration tomorrow, including some Israeli food. So we're going to talk a little bit about Yom Yerushalayim. We're going to this week's Parsha, Parshas Bamidbar, is that we start the fourth book of the Chumash. And the Parsha, its name is Bamidbar, means in the desert, and it's taken from the first word of the book. And as well as the name of the book and the name of the Parsha is the same, Bamidbar. Just the basic facts. So we're going to accomplish that tonight in the hour that we have together. So let's begin. Okay. All right. We're going to do a little share screen. Okay. So this is going to give everybody a basic video sense of what occurred 50 years ago tonight. In the Six-Day War. All right, so here's the video and we'll discuss it.
Marking the 40th anniversary of the Six-Days War, the wireless transmission carried by soldiers who broke through Jerusalem's old city continues to excite.
Okay, so that phrase, Har HaBayit Bi'adenu, the Temple Mount is in our hands, was spoken by the commander Mota Gur, who was leading the paratroopers into Jerusalem. And they got up to the Temple Mount, which, Adam, we will go up and you'll see in about 2 months, 10 weeks actually, is where the Dome of the Rock is. Okay? And then we have this scene. Okay, so now this is a recording of when the paratroopers went to the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, okay, which was much more narrow before they expanded the plaza area. And with them was the chief rabbi of the Israel Defense Force, Rabbi Shlomo Goren. And he's now saying a memorial prayer for all the guys that were killed in the war, which were many. You know, freedom is never free. He's singing, he's telling over, he's doing the Kel Malei Rachman, which we do at every funeral. Here we go.
Shochein Bamromim. Amcheinu Menucha Nechona. Al Kanfei Ashchina. Benalot Kedoshim. Giborim Vetorim. Ki Zohar HaKia Meirim Umazirim. Lenishmot. Chalalei Tzva Hagana Leisrael. Shenaflu.
Alright, so the last thing you heard was the shofar blast of that they blew when they liberated the thing. That's what you heard there with Rabbi Goren holding the Sefer Torah, and they were there. And of course, the accounts that you had people there who were part of the paratroopers that were not religious, but they felt a very powerful spiritual moment at that experience, which they would never forget. We had last year, maybe people have heard, David Sprung, he spoke to the Heritage Trip going ever near about how his group in 1967, how they felt that their winning the war against the Jordanians in particular and just being saved from, you know, being bombarded by mortar shells, they felt a very spiritual experience in that. All right, we're going to go to the next. So let me just let's go back to the... I'll go to another page. We're going to go to this. Okay. Now, so the rabbi you saw there was a guy named Shlomo Goren. I just want to, has anybody heard his name at all before? Have you ever heard of him before?
I haven't heard his name.
Okay, so I'll give you the explanation. All right. So Rabbi Shlomo Goren was a rabbi, you know, born in Europe, his family came to Israel after World War I. And he went to the yeshivas there in Jerusalem, and then he went to a yeshiva in Hebron called the Hebron Yeshiva. And he was trained, and he was extremely gifted. He was a gifted Torah scholar. He also went to Hebrew University, got an education. And as the British were leaving, he joined the Palmach, the Haganah, the various armed forces which became the Israeli Defense Force. He was trained as a paratrooper. The first prime minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, elected him the chief rabbi of the IDF, the Israel Defense Force. And he had the following idea. He said, look, we have one people, we got one land, and we have one army. And we have two groups of people. We have religious Jews and we have not religious Jews. But we have to be able to accommodate everybody. So he was critical in having kosher food available throughout the army. If a person wanted to daven and wanted to be observant, they could readily do so. And he created those accommodations. And he made he dealt with all the issues of complicated Jewish law, issues that deal with all things military. But one of his more famous moments was tonight, 50 years ago, he was there with the paratroopers as they got into Jerusalem, and he was there at the liberation of Jerusalem. He then went on with his driver to join them as they go to liberate Hebron. Now, Michael and Suzanne both went with me to the to Hebron and to the Maarat HaMachpelah. Here's the interesting thing. He conquered the city by himself. How's that possible? So he wanted to go with his group, but the commando unit left without him, and he thought, okay, he'll catch up to them going from Yerushalayim south to Hebron. The problem is that they were diverted in a different area, so he goes to Hebron. It's him, he and his driver, and they got guns. He shows up to Hebron, which is a Arab city. Now, you know, in 1929 and 1936, there was a pogrom where the Arabs went to the Jewish community of Hebron, and this is when there was British rule, and they went into the yeshiva where the guys were studying, and they stabbed them and hacked them to death. Many people died. It was like a pogrom. And obviously the complaint was that the British are in charge. They should have protected the Jews. So bad was that the Jews basically relocated out of Hebron. Here's the irony. So when the Arabs saw an Israeli jeep coming, they were afraid, together with Jordan, that they knew that they thought that the Israeli army's coming, and they were afraid there's going to be a retribution for the pogrom they did against the Jews in 1929 and 1936. So when he shows up there, everybody has the white flag. They basically gave up. So he shows up to reclaim Hebron. He did it by himself. One rabbi with a jeep. Done. So it's a kind of a crazy story. All right? That's like day five and a half, day six of the Six-Day War. So I asked you a simple question. What is strange about having a guy who, on one hand, is a warrior, all right? He's a paratrooper, and he's a rabbi in one. What do you find strange about that?
I'll probably say, because like you think that a rabbi would be very peaceful, and not encouraging war, also known as fighting. So it's like the two titles are in separate worlds. So to see someone in both worlds, it's unusual.
Adam, you're 100% correct. That's exactly the point. It's in our mind, we view like a rabbi as a person who's a scholar, who's not physically strong, who's kind of meek, weak, peaceful, loving, kindly. Not a guy who goes in there with his Uzi and Rambo-wise takes over an entire town by himself. Okay? All right? So, it seems to be a little bit, and during the 1948 war, the War of Independence, he actually was involved in military operation. He was, before he was the chief rabbi of the army, he was a paratrooper. Okay? So, this is interesting because this brings up an idea that we in America don't feel, but when you go to Israel, you will feel. Here's the deal. When you are running a country and you are the majority and you're in charge, you have to have all the elements of a successful country. You have to deal with all the threats. So you need a police force, you need an army, you need an air force, you need a Navy, you need special forces, you need everything. Okay? And reality, going back to the earlier Parshas, I asked you a question. Did Avram Avinu Did he go to war? Did Abraham go to war?
In Sodom and Gomorrah?
Well, he did not fight there. He prayed on their behalf to be saved. That's something we associate with a rabbi. Did Avram go to war ever? The answer is yes. I remind you of the story when his nephew Lot got captured in a regional war when there were the four kings fighting the five kings. And the four kings were victorious, and they abducted all the people of the town of Sodom. And Lot, his nephew, happened to be one of them. So the Torah tells us that he calls upon his men, 318 men, so he had a standing militia. So Avram had a platoon of warriors. Okay? And he does a daring midnight raid. When the four kings and their armies are relaxing after being successful in war, you can visualize they're roasting meat, they're drinking wine, they're enjoying their all the stuff they've captured in the war. And they are now, or so they imagine, are in control of the entire region. They had defeated the five kings and their armies, and now you have the four kings and their armies. And they have all their captured people. And then, in the night, in a daring midnight raid, comes Avram and 318 men, and basically terrorizes them, attacks them, dominates them, and then they capture everything. And of course, his main object, his nephew Lot, is saved. Okay? So did Avram kill people? Yes. Because as we say, there's a time for peace, and there's a time for war. And when the Jewish people for the last 2,000 years were a minority in a host country, we were basically weak and victimized. Now that we run our own country, we have to take on, we want peace, but we got to be prepared for war. And Rabbi Gorin, even though he's a peaceful man by nature, he's a rabbi, he's a scholar, a great Torah scholar, but, there's a place for an army. And he was, fantastic. And he was so beloved, they promoted him to become the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv afterward, which was, the chief rabbi, one of the chief rabbis of Israel. And he was actually more successful in the army. He was sort of used to the army phenomena. Okay? So that's the point. Part of our celebration of Jerusalem tonight is to recognize that the Jewish people, for the first time in history in the last, 69 years, have taken on responsibility for their own security. And that means putting forward a military. Now we get to our next thing. We're going to go to another, we get to our next videotape. Okay. This is called, I'm going to give you an explanation. It's in Hebrew, but it's with subtitles, so I hope your reading is good. This is called Sayeret Matkal. Sayeret Matkal is special forces, okay? But it's the special forces of the special forces. It's like, in America, equivalent to SEAL Team 6, okay? It's like the best of the best. Let's learn a little bit about them, all right? We're going to put it all together. You got to read this. You got to read the subtitles.
סיירת מטכ"ל, חוד החנית של צה"ל, משתייכת לאגף המודיעין, אמ"ן. על התפקיד העיקרי שלה, המודיעיני, כמעט ולא מדברים בתקשורת. הציבור הרחב מכיר אך ורק את הפעולות הגלויות של היחידה שמתחלקות בשלושה תחומים. חיסולים, חטיפות וחילוץ בני ערובה. תפקידם המרכזי של לוחמי היחידה הוא לחדור לעומק שטחן של מדינות אויב כדי לאסוף מודיעין אמין ואיכותי בזמן אמת. ההכנה לכל מבצע מודיעיני נמשכת חודשים ארוכים וכוללת עשרות תרגולים על מודלים.
בלא מעט מקרים מאשימים אותנו במרכאות בכך שביחידה עושים מבצעים מהסרטים. אז אני אומר לכולם, הסרטים עוד רחוקים מאוד מהמבצעים שעושים ביחידה, ולשפילברג יש עוד הרבה מאוד מה ללמוד.
לא מעט מן הפעולות השתמשו הלוחמים בתחפושות שונות ומשונות. במבצע אביב נעורים, בלב ביירות, התחפשו לוחמים לבחורות. במבצע סבנה התחפשו למכונאי מטוסים בסרבלים לבנים. גם בחיסול של אבו ג'יהאד וגם בהשתלטות על המחבלים בקו 300 היו לוחמים שהתחפשו לאזרחים. במבצע יונתן, באנטבה, הם התחזו ללוחמים בצבא אוגנדה וירדו ממטוס ההרקולס של חיל האוויר במרצדס השחורה והמפורסמת. בפעולה סודית שהסתבכה בלבנון במלחמה האחרונה התחפשו לוחמי היחידה על פי מקורות זרים לחיילים בצבא לבנון. במבצע הזה נהרג קצין בכיר, סגן אלוף עמנואל מורנו, שעליו נספר עוד מעט מהרחבה. שבועיים לפני כן, לעיני מצלמות, כמעט בשידור ישיר, פשטו לוחמי סיירת מטכ"ל יחד עם לוחמי שלדג, מתקן של חיזבאללה בבעלבק.
מידע שהתקבל הצביע שבבית החולים ובבונקר שנמצא מתחתיו, מסתתרים בכירים בחיזבאללה, וצהל הוחלט להגיע לבעלבק שבבקעת הלבנון, ולהביאם לישראל. הכוחות נחתו בחסות החשיכה ובחיפוי של מטוסי קרב, סמוך לבעלבק 100 קילומטרים בעומק השטח הלבנוני. הלוחמים סרקו את בית החולים חדר אחר חדר, אך לא מצאו את מי שחיפשו. חמישה פעילי חיזבאללה שהיו במקום נתפסו ונלקחו בשבי.
עשרות קצינים ולוחמים של סיירת מטכ"ל השתתפו במבצע הזה, שרבים ראו בו מבצע ראווה. לאחר מעשה נמתחה ביקורת נוקבת על הפעולה, שבמהלכה נחטפו בין היתר שני אזרחים לבנונים, רק בגלל ששמם הוא חסן נסראללה. המטכ"ל לשעבר, רב אלוף משה יעלון, הגדיר את המבצע כהרפתקני, וקבע שלא היה מוצדק במונחים של עלות, סיכון ותועלת. בצמרת צה"ל יחישו בתוקף את דבריו.
Okay, well, I'm not sure you... Okay, all right, so here's a couple things. Let's do a little... All right, so here's the basic thing. All right, so... Suzanne, read the basic Wikipedia description of the Sayeret Matkal.
Is a special forces unit of the Israel Defense Forces. First and foremost, a field intelligence gathering unit conducting deep reconnaissance behind enemy lines to obtain strategic intelligence. Sayeret Matkal is also tasked with counterterrorism and hostage rescue beyond Israel's borders. The unit is modeled after the British Army's Special Air Service, taking the unit's motto, "Who Dares Wins." The unit is the Israeli equivalent of Delta Force of the United States and to the UK's Special Air Service. It is directly subordinate to the IDF's Directorate of Military Intelligence.
Okay, so basically you saw, how do they prepare for a mission? Did you catch that? Who remembers that piece? How do they prepare for a mission?
They simulate it dozens of times.
Right, so they actually build models. For example, well, what's the most famous Sayeret Matkal?
Entebbe.
Right, the Entebbe raid was done by Sayeret Matkal, of course. The head of that was Benjamin Netanyahu's brother, Yoni Netanyahu, who unfortunately was the one victim who was shot by the Ugandan soldiers, died. When we went in Israel we went to the Har Herzl Military Cemetery, we went to his grave. So he's a Sayeret Matkal. But most of the other prime ministers, Ehud Barak, former prime minister, as well as Ben Netanyahu, has been part of this special forces unit. So they do a lot of preparation. What else do they do? What's part of their deal? Do they come in with overwhelming force? Is their approach to deal with overwhelming? Is there? For example, by the is their method like the Rambo method? Like come in with like you know big strong dudes and just blowing everything up?
No, they're slick disguises.
Right. First of all, number one, they use disguises. They tried to blend in. One of the things they referenced was their famous. They went into Beirut, you know, Beirut, Lebanon. Where the masterminds and of the 1972 Olympic killings of the Israeli athletes, as you know, Black September, the PLO came and abducted and ultimately killed the I think 11 or 12 Israeli. Athletes who were living in the Olympic Village in Munich, Germany. Are you guys familiar with that? So they vowed that everybody who was involved in this terrorist raid will be found and dealt with. Three of them were hiding out in Beirut, which is, you know, deep into PLO and foreign. So they got in there by boat. They had Mossad agents there. One guy dressed up as a guy and one guy dressed up as a woman, and they walked past the Lebanese army guys. They had houses they found that they got the plans for, right? Which were and the person who built that apartment building also had an identical apartment building in Tel Aviv. They practiced, as they said, for weeks to go in there quickly, find the place, find the right guy. They had a grainy picture of the guy. Knock on the door, identify a guy, and quietly shoot him. They were successful. They did, and that's one of the things that they were able to knock out three different enemy places at the exact same time. Get out, get back to the beach, get onto their super fast rubberized dinghies, and get to the main ship, and you know, and achieve their goal undetected, and without getting killed. So they're more mind than brawn. The goal is to use the enemy's assumptions against them. Okay, so when they went to Entebbe, they brought this big Hercules cargo plane, and they had the president of Idi Amin, the dictator of Uganda, who had all the Jewish prisoners. This is July 4th, 1976, and they snuck in as being Ugandan people with the prime minister of Uganda to get into the terminal where the soldiers. Terrorists were keeping this all. Have you guys seen Operation Thunderbolt? Have you guys seen that movie? Now you should check that out. It talks about play by play how these guys, Sayer Maktal, went in and rescued the Entebbe raid was the number one most daring hostage rescue mission in military history. Okay? Now, my question to you guys. Question number two. What is uniquely Startup Nation about Sayeret Matkal? Israel's called the Startup Nation. Who can tell me? So what's like a Startup Nation about the Sayeret Matkal? Are you guys familiar with the term Startup Nation? Have you heard that phrase? Moshe Chaim, can you explain that? What does that mean? What's the concept by Israel being referred to as a startup nation?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
What does it mean by Israel's called a startup nation?
by Israel being called the Startup Nation.
Yes. Why is it called that?
That there's so many startups there that so much of our new technology starts in Israel and then spreads elsewhere and gets developed.
Correct. So what is uniquely Startup Nation about the approach of Sayeret Matkal?
That other military forces copy what Israel does. They come up with it and then it spreads.
First of all, that's point number one. But what's their approach? They have a certain... What's their derech? They have a certain methodology.
Life comes first and your people shouldn't die first?
Well, I mean, obviously... You know, SEAL Team 6 also has that belief. Everybody has that belief. But what they have a certain methodology to deal with the situation.
Get intelligence first and know what it is you're fighting and how you're fighting.
I mean, I think all the army... But they're very... They're uniquely in the David and Goliath mode. They are uniquely talented in using, you know... outsmarting the enemy, of working on ways to use their wisdom and intelligence to be able to, and use the people's assumptions against them. You know what I'm saying? Just like Goliath had the best weaponry and he's a big, strong guy, but David found a weakness, and he used his slingshot and is able to direct his slingshot right at his temple and kill him, which, by the way, people who are, you know, who use slingshots all the time know that you can use it as a precise deadly weapon. It's a well-established fact. So that's the kind of thing. Now, so not only do the great rabbi bring wisdom to the military action, it spreads it to people who are regular, who are, you know, who are not great rabbis, people who are, you know, part of the special forces. Each one has special talents, but the idea is to try to use the wisdom, their God-given wisdom, to be able to navigate, to find a solution. As their basic model is, we got to, you know, every problem, there's got to be, there must be a solution. The solution is there, you got to find it. And that's a method, that's a mentality they have. Okay. So with that introduction, I want to get to our Parsha, okay? And we're going to put this all together. All right, so let me have our good friend, our Moshe Chaim, give us a read here.
Okay, from Bamidbar, the census?
Yeah.
God spoke to Moshe in the Sinai Desert in the tent on the first day of the second month in the second year of the Exodus, saying, take a census of the entire Israelite community, do it by families following the paternal line, according to the names of each male taken individually. You and Aharon shall take a tally of them by their divisions, counting every male over 20 years old who is fit for military service. Alongside you there shall be one man from each tribe, and he shall be the head of his paternal line.
Okay, stop right there. Why are they taking this count?
Military service, know who can fight.
Why now?
Because they're going to have to go into Canaan and fight for Israel.
Correct. So the Jewish people have basically been in Sinai for a year, okay? We're celebrating Shavuos in a couple of weeks, 2 weeks. And the Jewish people have, you know, with a little bit of a distraction called the Golden Calf, they basically have been there for basically a little more than a year, and they received the Torah, and they built the Mishkan, and basically it's showtime at the Apollo. It's time for them to go invade the land of Canaan. So what do you got to do? You got to have a military. All right? Apparently, there was not to be the God's miracles were done once to get him out of Mitzrayim. He wasn't apparently going to be doing miracles, or not open miracles, on their way into Canaan. They got to have an army. Let's keep on going.
The total.
Right, so I skipped the 40 verses to talk about the count, so, you know.
You want all the names?
No. I didn't want to read all the names, correct.
These are the tallies made by Moshe, Aaron, and the 12 men who were princes of Israel, one from each paternal family. The tally of Israelites according to their paternal families include those over 20 years old, all fit for military service. The entire tally was 603,550.
Okay.
However, the men who were Levites according to their father's tribe were not tallied together with the other Israelites.
All right, so the amount of men who were of military age, in other words, above 20, was 603,550. But they didn't count the Levi tribe. Okay? We'll have to understand why not. All right, the Levium. Go on.
God spoke to Moshe, saying, "Do not take a tally or census of the Levites together with the other Israelites. Put the Levium in charge of the tabernacle of testimony."
That's the Mishkan. That's the Mishkan.
All its furniture and everything pertaining to it, they shall carry the Mishkan and all its furniture, and they will serve in it. They shall therefore camp around the Mishkan. When the Mishkan is moved, the Levium shall take it down, and when it is to remain in one place, they shall set it up. Any non-Levite who participates shall die.
All right, stop right there. So why aren't the Levium included in the count, or why do they have a separate count?
They need to be Tahor for handling the duties of the Mishkan?
Well, counting does not make them not Tahor.
But they can't serve in the military.
Well, they do not serve the military, and their public service is about, in the desert, is about transporting, is unpacking, setting up, packing, transporting the Mishkan. That's their job. Okay? Let's keep on going.
When the Israelites camp, each individual shall be in his own camp, each one designated by the banner for its military division. The Levium, however, shall camp around the Mishkan so that there will not be any divine anger directed against the Israelites. It shall be the Levium who safeguard the tribe of the Mishkan. The Israelites did all that God commanded Moshe, and they did it exactly.
Okay, so here's the deal. So The Jews are not only they counted, but they're now organized into what unit?
Military.
Well, but how are they organized amongst themselves?
By tribe.
By tribe, and they get their own. What do they got? They got a flag and a banner, and then there's the four tribe. And then what's in the center of the camp?
The Mishkan.
Who camps around the Mishkan?
The Levium.
The Levium. And who camps around the Levium?
The 11 other tribes.
Correct. And they're organized into four quadrants. Each three tribes are into a brigade. Okay? So this is very interesting. So let me go. All right, so we answered, why was it census taken now? Answer, because it's time for invasion time. Why are only 20 years old and up counted? Because those are people who are, you know, you don't draft 45-year-old people in the army. In America, you draft 18, and in Israel, 18, but in the time of the Chumash, it was 20. All right. Now, why are they being organized by tribe? Apparently before this, they were not. Everybody could live wherever they wanted.
Work as a unit.
Okay. So when you're part of the same tribe, which is what's in the tribe?
A leader.
Well, there's a leader that we saw before. And not only that, every family within the tribe is also a sub-leader. So you have, like, in a certain sense, you already have what they call a chain of command. You got your general. You got your colonel. You got your major, your sergeant. You're private, okay? Now, the key question I want to get to is, why are they being organized in a military fashion? Are the Jewish people now on a military base? I understand you need to count the people. And I understand the people that you got to be in the army. So when they attack them, they'll call and say, "All right, all guys, come on, we're going to go over there, we're going to go over on that hill, and we're going to fight the Canaanim." Okay? We'll do the invasion. But whenever they, but they even have to do what? When they're traveling through the desert, they got to be in what? A military formation. They camp in a military base, and they move with military precision. Certain tribes go ahead. The Levium and the Aaron and the Mishkan is in the center, and the rest of them are behind. Why do they have to be in a military base? Not, they're not going to face war when they're in the desert.
Do you think this is mentally preparing them?
Ah! Go ahead. Go on there, Suzanne. On the money. On the money, Suzanne. Go ahead.
Yeah, to not be schlubs. So they could be ready and get in that mindset. And in case, you know, they're preparing. It's like when they put kids that are in trouble in a boot camp. It starts to train them and get their thinking that certain way.
That's excellent. Now, why do they need it so much in advance? Why do they have to get in that headspace now?
All their physical needs are being taken care of, so they need something to do and to start being independent in some way.
Well, first of all, why do they have to organize themselves in this, you know, camp, march, and organize themselves in this military fashion? And starting now.
Get ingrained.
Why do they need more people to be ingrained? What are they equivalent of, I mean, in the military process?
They're the new recruits.
They're the new recruits. And also, what's their background? Are they coming from a strong military tradition right now? What were they doing a year ago? What were the Jewish people doing a year ago?
The plagues in the triumph?
Well, they were working for Paro. They were slaves. Now, could you go from being a slave to a warrior? Is that an easy transition?
No, that takes a lot of mental. You have to break them down and build them back up.
Break them down, build them. What quality is the most central that has to be developed here? Or qualities? Here's the question. How do you take a slave and shift him into a soldier? Adam, what do you think?
Into a slave and train to be a soldier.
What would be the necessary ingredients to make that happen? What is a slave missing to make him a good soldier?
To be a good soldier, I would say you need to have inner strength in order to build yourself into the physical, get yourself to that physical level you have to be at to be the best soldier you can be.
All right, so there is a conditioning, physical conditioning component. But then you said, a mental component. Within the mental component, what qualities of those inner mental qualities are the most needed?
Stability, I would say, because based on what I know about the military, you're constantly training, and like it's not like a work. You're training as though you're an athlete, but at a higher level, like it's nonstop, and you have to have them mentally tough to go through that.
Ah, mental toughness. Were these mentally tough people? Slaves?
No,
they were mentally fragile people. These are the people that were constantly being beaten by their masters. These are people that were afraid of the Egyptians. So they need to develop courage, confidence, toughness. Okay? You can't take slaves and turn them into warriors. So as Suzanne pointed out, you got to start a little earlier. And they got to start changing their mindset. Part of that was, you're now counted. Who's being counted? You're being counted in the Army. In a certain sense, it has a role, and you're being... They didn't count... They were... Every name was put down of the age, and they counted the names in the book. Basically, it's equivalent to a modern-day draft. They're being mentally drafted to a new role. Two, they're organized by tribes. The advantage of when you have a tribe, you feel a closeness to your tribe, because a tribe is an extension of your family. And you'll help each other out. They're like on your team. You feel a closeness, okay? In fact, in military, they oftentimes put people who are regionally connected, like the Philadelphia group. They have different kinds of... the military uses, throughout all the militaries of the world, using tribal connections and regional connections to build a certain cohesiveness. Warrior cohesiveness. Okay? Next, they got to be put in a... They're now on a military base. All right? They're not just camping out in the desert. They're in a military base. All right? Interestingly enough, the Rambam, when talks about... Let's read what he has to say here. Let me just make it a little bigger because it's a little small. All right, so Suzanne, if you can read it.
Okay. It is contrary to man's nature that he should suddenly abandon all the different kinds of divine service and the different customs in which he has been brought up and which have been so general that they were considered as a matter of course. It would be just as if a person trained to work as a slave with mortar and bricks or similar things should interrupt his work, clean his hands, and at once fight with real giants. It was the result of God's wisdom that the Israelites were led about in the wilderness till they acquired courage. It is a well-known fact that traveling in the wilderness and privation of bodily enjoyment, such as bathing, produce courage, whilst the reverse is the source of faint-heartedness. Besides, another generation rose during the wanderings that had not been accustomed to degradation and slavery. All the traveling in the wilderness was regulated by divine commands through Moses. At the commandment of the Lord they rested, and at the commandment of the Lord they journeyed. They kept the charge of the Lord and the commandment of the Lord by the hand of Moses.
Okay, so the first generation, the people who left Egypt, they had to be toughened up. What you phrased before, Suzanne, was spot on. The Jews had to be put into a boot camp. They got to understand they're being drafted. They have to understand they're now in a military formation. They have to understand that they are mentally being transferred, and they're not being checked into the Prima King's Hotel on the corner of King George thing, where they're getting a buffet breakfast every morning, which was fantastic. So they're not being pampered. They're toughing it out, right?
We believe that they had them on and that their clothes and everyone fell apart.
Yeah, but that was still, yeah, so they got their clothes lasted, but they're not really having, you know, five-star accommodations. They have their needs met, but it is an unpleasant experience. You're still camping for a long time. You know what I mean? And part of it, as far as the Rambam, was in fact to... Because for them to go from, he's explaining why God did not lead the Jews up the coast, go from Egypt straight up the coast into Gaza and fight the Plishtim. It would have taken one day to get there. What would have happened? They would have gone and hit scene war, and they would have turned around and ran back home, because you cannot just go from building a pyramid, wash your hands, pick up a sword, and find a warrior. Right? This does not happen. Right? Not, you know, even when you see those movies and you know, Gladiator, right? When you see guys get stuck in the Colosseum there, and the people who are not used to fighting, they get killed in a second. They're not used to it. So they had to be stiffened up. So here's the key thing. When God works with the Jewish people, there's always two benefits. There's a material benefit, and there's an educational benefit. So what's the material benefit of being organized in this fashion? We've already said it, but let's put it into simple, clear terms. What's the material benefit that the Jews had by being organized in a military manner, in a military base? What's the practical material benefit? Moshe Chaim.
Accustomed them to the chain of command and to living the military life or being part of a military unit.
Exactly. Now, but this military base is a little different than any other military base in the world. What is in the center of their military base?
The Shekhinah, Mishkan.
The Mishkan and the Shekhinah and the Leviim. Well, what does that communicate?
That's what they're guarding and what's important.
It both things. It shows, A, what's the idea? Basically, we're protecting the source of Hashem's wisdom, which is communicated from God through the Mishkan to Moshe. A. And B, we recognize that our success is based upon our service in the Mishkan, our connection to the service, and fundamentally our connection to God. We do not have a feeling that we are going to be successful independent of God. So it's sort of a balance between A, we're being trained to be a military, right? But simultaneously we're not losing sense that we are in control of everything. Hashem will help those who help themselves. Hashem will help those who have a plan. So quite frankly, the modern state of Israel, which I share with you, you had Rabbi, why did Rabbi Gorin felt it was important to risk his life, to be on the front line of the invasion of the old city of Jerusalem, you know, tonight, 50 years ago? Why did he do that? What were some of the important messages he wanted to do there? And actually, there's a lot of reasons he did that. But what educational reasoning did he want to do that? In fact, you know, really putting himself in harm's way. There were Jordanian snipers all over the place. It was a dangerous environment. A lot of guys got killed. It wasn't like, you know, they walked in there and people said, oh, okay, we'll leave. It was a fierce, you know, we're talking about door-to-door war. It's very brutal. So why do you do it? What do you guys think? Moshe Chaim, what do you think?
Why he was first and put himself in that situation?
Yeah, why do you think it was so important to do that?
Because he thought that the soldiers needed to see that someone spiritual and, you know, connected to God believed that this was the right thing to do for the sake of God, that it wasn't just violence at the hands of their superiors.
Correct. So he walked in there, he was carrying a Torah in one hand and a shofar in another hand. And he wanted to sort of underscore that the Jewish people reclaiming its sovereign city and the Temple Mount, the place of the Mishkan, was an opportunity for a spiritual rebirth. And really, that this is a tremendous blessing from God to even receive this. And he wanted, and it was important for him to, to communicate this to everybody and to the world. And everybody... him blowing the shofar at the Kotel, him leading in the prayers at the Kotel, were recorded and were not only recorded but were played live throughout the world. You have to understand the emotional significance of this. When this was played, Jews in America and in Canada and in Europe and South America, they heard this, they literally cried. Because the Jews were denied the opportunity to be in half of Jerusalem. And four days earlier, they had dug 10,000 graves in Tel Aviv because the people felt it was going to be another Holocaust. Okay? So you don't understand emotionally going from, you hear the head of Egypt saying, we're going to throw all the Jews into the water. I'm going to meet President Hussein of Jordan and Assad from Syria. We're going to all have lunch together in Tel Aviv. And we're going to kill all the Jews. Okay? And then going from that to having Rabbi Shlomo Goren blowing the shofar at the Kotel. And the people davening there for the first time as they'd done in 30 years. So it was a very emotional thing. Here's the key point, putting it all together. So basically, the Judaism wants to have a balanced approach. Until the time of the Messiah, there will always be enemies of Israel. We say it every year in the Seder. In every generation they arise, and God helps us and kills, God rescues us from their hands. But Hashem's going to rescue us if we, in fact, take the initiative. This initiative is reflected in the Chumash. Where the Jews are being organized in a military base, military position, chain of command, organized by tribe. They have their own flag. They have their own banner. They're marching in a certain protocol. And simultaneously, they're not losing that their purpose of this war and the purpose of the military is the Mishkan, is the word of Hashem. And that really is the guiding force and animating force of the Jewish people. And that balance of both the military and the wisdom of God fused together creates a courageous person who at one time, it's a time to learn, like we're doing right now. And another time, it's a time to pick up a rifle and shoot the enemy before they shoot you. You know what I'm saying? There's a time for everything. And that's what Rav Goren, and the wisdom not only was expressed on, the rabbi's warrior, but even the regular warriors, they always had a wisdom-based approach, sort of to apply the wisdom of God in their circumstances. That's why they planned and they strategized and they sought better and better intelligence. And they found all the ways, sneaky ways, to find out what the enemy's doing so they can be able to be better prepared to protect the Jewish people, both in Israel and beyond. And that's what we should celebrate tonight. Tonight is Yom Yerushalayim, tonight and tomorrow, is that we have the gift of a liberated city of Jerusalem, which Adam and I will walk together with in 10 weeks. And Moshe Chaim and Suzanne, I had the opportunity of walking with you guys a number of years back. It was, one of our best, fantastic trips. My trips to Israel with the fellows is, in my life, is one of the most special moments in my life. And I think you guys feel his way. And that gift that we enjoyed was accomplished 50 years tonight. And we're very grateful to Hashem and all the people that worked selflessly and gave sacrificially to make that happen. So I want to show everybody a Yom Yerushalayim Sameach, a happy Jerusalem day. And if anybody's in the Upper West Side tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, there'll be delicious Yom Yerushalayim food in our festivities. Food and festivities. All right, guys, have a great night, and Chag Sameach.
Rabbi, question real quickly.
Yes.
Just, are you guys organizing something for the Israel march in a couple of weeks?
Yes, June 4th. I think we step off 10:30. We have a very early, relatively early. We get a prime position in the march. We're one of the first to march.
Okay. Is there somewhere I can email about that if my family was interested?
Yes. Go online. You can sign up tonight.
Okay. Thanks, Rabbi.
Excellent, guys. Have a good night.
All right. Good night.